Edition. I'm your host, Dr. K, sitting in for Sean Yost. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Later on the hour, we'll speak with teachers about the best possible ways to address white supremacy in the classroom and why everyone should be teaching about this on the first day of school. But first, we start the conversation about the rise of white supremacy, asking the question about what we can do, how we can understand it, and if you are a white person, how you can move from being an accomplice, well, actually move from being an ally to being an accomplice. It's two different things, and we're going to talk about that. We want to remind our listeners to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 889. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition. Also connect with Sean on his personal Twitter account, tag at Sean Yost, and Facebook page Sean Yost with information, insight, and breaking news. To begin our conversation, we have two of our main folks back up in the house. Lester Spence is here. He's an award-winning author and associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. Lester, welcome back, sir.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's good to be here.
And we also have Dr. Rob Helfenbein. He's associate dean of the School of Education at Loyola University, Maryland. We welcome you back, Rob.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get right into our conversation. We're going to ask our listeners to join us at 410-319-8888. Dr. Les, I want to come to you. So we keep calling it the rise of white supremacy, but I'm not sure if it's something that's new. Can you talk a little bit about how people should be thinking about white supremacy now?
Well, so if you think about, for example, the statues that were taken down in Baltimore last week, if you look at the dates, right, the dates aren't 1865. They weren't taken down, like, after the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. They were taken, at the end of the Civil War. They were erected as Baltimore had an influx of black folk and the kind of private housing market was developing, and they decided to segregate, right? So you can look at that. You can look going back from 1619 to now and find these moments where you've got white supremacists actually using either private power or public power to kind of bake white supremacy into private action, to corporate action, and then on one hand, and then into political action on the other. So when we talk about the rise of white supremacy in this modern moment, we're not actually being accurate. What we're looking at, and that's actually pretty deep as I think about it, what we're actually looking at are the death throes of a certain type of white supremacy, right? That is to say that people are rising up because they see this way of life. I mean, heck, if you look at the moment in time when the statues were erected,
right,
that was a lost cause project. They called it the lost cause. Mm. Right. They called it the lost cause.
Right.
They're like, the Confederacy was a lost cause that we actually want to instantiate so people don't forget it.
Right.
Right. So when we're tearing it down or when people are trying to build it back up again, it's like lost cause 2.0.
Right.
So it's not quite the rise, whether we're looking at the United States or we're looking at something at Brexit. What we're looking at are the death throes.
Right.
Now, it's not dead, and it's our project to kill it, but one of the things we really have to say out loud over and over again is, like, it's not a rise unless you count somebody dying on the ground and slapping people around while they're dying a rise.
Right. So can you just also kind of give us the difference? Because people keep using these terms interchangeably. White supremacist, neo-Nazi, alt-right, they're kind of pulling all those together, and I think people are getting confused. Can you parse them apart for us a little bit?
So the term alt-right is a broad encompassing term to encompass kind of a white supremacist, like KKK type folk, Nazis who kind of overlap with white supremacists but are kind of different, and then conservatives kind of not broadly, but broadly with a small b.
Okay.
Right? And it was done in part because there are a number of white folk. We've at least transitioned in the United States to a moment where racism is actually impolite.
Right.
That doesn't mean we're not racist. That doesn't mean that people don't hold racist ideas, but it's kind of impolite. So the term alt-right is used as an all-encompassing umbrella that can be used to basically cover white supremacy and racism, right?
Okay.
So you've got alt-right folk who encompass a number of folk, and then you've got people who are straight up neo-Nazis or white supremacists who will actually claim that out loud.
Okay. See, that's moving us to a different moment. Let me pull you into the conversation, Rob, because I once heard you talk about how when you were younger, I think when you were teaching, so maybe a little bit younger, that the KKK would hold marches and they would march through. But there was something different about those marches, even though it was a KKK in their hoods, than what happened in Charlottesville.
Right. So I grew up in North Carolina, and my first job was a middle school teacher in Apex, North Carolina. And the Klan would march every year. But one of the things that I was thinking about and that what was different in Charlotte is at least during the light of day, right? So I'm not saying that the Klan wasn't violent in doing all kinds of things under cover of night and different times, certainly. But during the day, the Klan marched, but they did not have guns and they did not have baseball bats, right? And so to me, there is something that is a shift in terms of what those folks think is okay now, right? What they're able to do now.
Now, with that, what happened in Boston recently, so we've talked a lot on WEAA about Charlottesville, and I think the country has paused for a moment to think deeply about Charlottesville, whether it's Donald Trump's three statements about Charlottesville, where he doubled back down to inform us that it was both sides, not just one, or thinking about Heather Harris' mother's comment about, you know, they want us to forget my daughter. We're going to lift her up. And then we turn to Boston, where I believe you might have had 44 members or so of the alt-right less, and then you had 22,000 to 40,000 people saying, not here, not that's now. Right. How should we understand this moment?
So when I talk about the death row, so that's one way to understand what I mean by death rows, right? So when so death row, T-H-R-O-E-S. So there are some forms of death where when the person is actually dying, they're thrashing about. And if you're not careful, you can actually, in interacting with this person, you could actually catch an L yourself, you know, so to speak. Right. So how would we take that idea and then kind of see that socially, if we were to apply that idea socially? So one way to see that, if you go to a place like Boston, and we're all the same age on the panel, we grew up thinking that Boston was a pretty racist place.
Yes, that's what I've always
heard. Right, right, right. Like you don't go to a Boston Red Sox game because you're going to catch it, even if you support the Boston Red Sox, right? But so you take a city that we actually have, we believe is kind of got a racist history. That's not that historic.
Right.
And you get tens of thousands of people fighting against racism.
Right.
Saying we stand against racism. Right. That's a sign that we're in a different moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. And that's a sign. So that's a sign that the folks who voted for Trump, like your alt-right folks, are saying, okay, we're fighting against that. And they're seeing that and saying, we're fighting a losing battle. And they're actually not all the way wrong.
Right. Okay.
Right.
We'll talk about that a little bit.
Right. Right. So one of the challenges of us, of people on our end of the ideological spectrum, and then, you know, you and us having the black politics we have, folks like us, where we have a tendency to argue that racism is the same. It's like transhistorical.
Right.
So
right.
If we go back to 1700, that racism is only different from 2017 a little bit.
Right.
Right. The whole concept of the new Jim Crow, it's like this is just Jim Crow now, but it's different.
Right.
But what we lose when we take that approach is we actually lose the fact that 30 years ago, they would have been, it wouldn't have been 40,000 people fighting.
Right.
Right? I mean, we can go back to the moment when they actually tried to desegregate the schools in Boston.
Yeah.
And the white working class basically stood up in rebellion, right? For that moment. This is not that. Now, this doesn't mean that we've come to that moment where everything is fine. It's not. But it does mean that when they're saying our way of life is dying, that we're fighting for a lost cause, that we have to fight for a way of life that's no longer prevalent, that our kids no longer buy into, they're actually right. So when we're fighting for this, what we have to understand, at least on this axis, is we're actually fighting on the right side of history. This isn't something where we've got forces arrayed against us. Trump had to steal the election to win.
Right. Right.
Bush in 2000 and 2004 had to basically steal an election to win.
Right.
They didn't win. Reagan won the election straight out. That difference is important.
I think it's important to note, too, when you talk about being on the right side of history, that we're having this conversation today. I mean, when we start thinking about where we are on the historical spectrum, we're thinking now about the Nat Turner uprising, which was 186 years ago. We're thinking about the uprising of the Haitian Revolution, which was 200 years ago. So being on the right side of history at this moment actually means something. Rob, I want to come over to you because you were talking about, in our conversations before, about how you want to talk to white people. Like, there's something about talking to white folks about where they should be at this moment. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at this theory of moving from being an actor to being an ally to being an accomplice. Mm-hmm. What exactly does that mean? And before you go on, I want to remind people that they're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. If you want to join the conversation, 410-319-8888. Clarence, we're going to come to you next after Rob kind of answers that question for us.
So the easiest way I can answer that is in my experience these days, I don't want people to tell me that they're not racist. Mm-hmm. I want people to tell me how they're anti-racist.
Okay.
Right? So what is it that you're doing, right, that directly confronts the systemic racism, institutional racism, privilege, and disrupt that, right, actively? So it's real easy to say I'm not a racist, right?
Right.
It's real easy to say I don't support the Nazis. The question has to be, in what ways are we complicit with systems that marginalize certain folks, right? And that what that's going to mean is we white folks are going to have to give up some of their power.
And so what does that look like? So when we start thinking about these terms, right, actor, where you're participating, mm-hmm. ally, where you're willing to stand in solidarity, accomplice means what? You're getting out on front, in the front of the struggle. You're being there in Boston.
Trying to dismantle it.
Like, you're doing hands-on work.
Yeah.
But for some white folks, what does that mean? Like, how do they start doing this? It's not just enough to say, I want to do it, because wanting to do something and actually doing it are two different things, right?
That's right. I mean, I think it could show up in a couple of different ways. But, I think it is fantastic that 20,000 people showed up in Boston, right? But that's allyship,
right,
is what that is, right? If it's going to be accomplice, the question is, are you actively working, right, against these systems as they're set up? So that could be legislative, mm-hmm. right? Right, as we have talked about too, like moving from statues to statutes,
right?
Which is a Adam Jackson quote. I'll give him credit for that because it's a good one. It's
leaders
a good one.
Of a beautiful struggle.
Yeah, yes. It's a good one. And so think about the work that Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle is doing, for example, right? In terms of bail reform, they're down in Annapolis. They put the call out, right, for folks to come and support their work, whether that's financially, whether it's physically. And it's also asking folks to talk to their elected officials, right? And trying to leverage, frankly, to leverage privilege, right? In my neighborhood, election time, candidates are in my neighborhood all the time. I saw a lot of Catherine Pugh in my neighborhood, right? But, you know, going a few blocks over, right, and doing some work with my friends with the No Boundary Coalition, they didn't see much of Catherine Pugh.
So they need to be able to show up, and then demand for them to be in these other neighborhoods. That's accomplice work.
That's right.
Working to dismantle. Let me go to the phones. Clarence, welcome to First Edition. How can I help you, sir?
Yes, I'd like to make a couple statements. First of all, white supremacy and neo-Nazism, however you want to term that. White supremacy has always been neo-Nazism. You can't separate the two historically. A neo-Nazi is a white supremacist. Here in America, we're kind of merging these two groups have found common ground in this point in time, common ground under different names. They are both the same historically. Now, those people that are out there aren't watching the instruction set or the controlling element behind neo-Nazi and white supremacists, which is fascism. They do not realize while they're out there with the hate thing, I hate blacks, browns, and everything else, that the control element, the people who are taking away their civil rights behind the scenes, that is the real issue. So whatever's happening in the streets nowadays, there's a control element behind it, which is, I would say, corporate America, who wants to seize all of the wealth in the country and hand it over to a few elite while we're distracted, mm-hmm. and while they're pushed on the street with these demonstrations and these rallies and marches under the guise of we hate these other people because they are the problem. If you were to, if you could set me down, and this might be pie in the sky, with David Duke, and I say, David, while you're sitting here and you're telling your people to go out on the street with these rallies about white supremacy, do you realize that your civil rights and you, your rights are being encroached upon? I have no power, so why is your energy focused towards me? You should be going in the other direction. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. Let me just kind of unpack that a little bit, Lester, because Clarence made a number of really good points. But this idea that he is saying white supremacy, neo-Nazism, is all the same thing. Is that similar to what you were saying, that we are now at the death throes to trying to see how these pieces are coming together?
Yeah, so the white supremacy movement and the neo-Nazi movement is pretty much is coterminous. There is enough overlap you can say they're the same thing. There are elements of the alt-right who do not think of themselves, who find the neo-Nazis distasteful, who don't believe in white supremacy. They're only in a coalition for like temporary reasons, but the white supremacists and neo-Nazis are all on the same page, and they're all part enough, they're all close enough to the same page where we can critique them, right? If we're just analyzing them, I think it's important intellectually to think about differences, but politically we can think about them as the same thing. The way I would challenge is that capital isn't – so when Trump has to basically shut down, he had two basically corporate boards that he shut down. And the reason he shut them down is because folks – in those corporate boards resigned. Enough folks in the corporate boards resigned where they couldn't function. If capital functioned purely the way that that the brother articulated, they still would have been on the program.
Right.
Right. So, I'm pretty anti-capitalist. I think but with that said, it's important to note that there is a difference between an Apple, for example, and a Chick-fil-A.
So
Cook, who's the CEO of Apple now, he's not on that white supremacist program at all. He's on the capitalist program.
Right.
But he knows that he's not going to be able to sell iPhone at the very least. Like, besides the fact that he's gay and he's not in the program, right? He's not in the white supremacist program. They don't want him. Besides that fact, he's not going to be able to sell iPhones and iPads and Macs to the kids who are starting at Morgan in next week, to the kids who are starting at Hopkins next week, to the kids who are using iPhones up in Baltimore, in LA, in San Francisco, in Oakland, in all these metropolitan spaces in which folks realize the world is different.
Right.
Chick-fil-A is another project, though.
Right.
Right? So the Chick-fil-A person, not knocking Chick-fil-A, but you can see the Chick-fil-A person saying, wow, this is the project I support because I'm an evangelical. I'm a white evangelical of a certain type, and I kind of want this Confederate / neo-Nazi project.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's important we make a distinction about capital, not just for intellectual purposes, but for political purposes. If for those of us who are interested in kind of creating another form of life, they're not all the same.
Right.
So but where it do is, we go from it, here? Yes, Rob,
it,
come on in.
It is important, though, that we talk about capitalism. Right. As part of the moment that we're in and the set of forces that is at work. And oftentimes we don't. Right. We kind of categorize. Yeah. Well, we're talking about race. Right. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the term now is intersectionality that a lot of people
Kimberly
are talking
Crenshaw's
about.
Kimberly Crenshaw's term.
Right. So we've got to talk about those things as in relation.
Right.
Capitalism is in relation with racial politics, gender capitalism, sexuality capitalism. I mean, that's part of what has to be the mix if we're really going to get a nuanced understanding of what's going down.
And that gives us a way to talk about accompliship, not just amongst whites on the racial axis, but then actually amongst blacks on the class axis.
And that's the question I was really going to ask. That's where I was going next. That Rob kind of laid out, you know, how white folks could move from actor to ally to accomplice. But I'm meeting a lot of black people say, well, what can I do? I am not going to, for example, go down to Charlottesville. I know a lot of black folk in Charlottesville say that is not our march. I'm looking for my white friends to be down there, not me. So what should black, because if they're going out of the house, is already putting your body on the line. So what should black folks be doing right now?
So in places like Baltimore, what black folks should be doing is what some black folks have already been doing, like contributing to a project Like you've got folks in Tent City.
That's
Lawrence Brown.
More block. Those
yeah,
folks
straight
are
up
down
Morgan
there.
State. Represent.
8 days and hounding.
Yeah, yeah. So they've been articulating a vision for the city that actually argues that the city should be spending more of its resources on dealing with health issues that affect black working class folk and working class in general, unemployment issues that affect black working class folk and folk in general, infrastructure issues that affect black working class folk and folk in general. What can happen is black folk on the middle to upper end of the economic spectrum can actually support those projects, mm-hmm. right? They can support those projects in a number of ways.
I think down in Tent City, they're actually saying if you are someone in medicine, if you are someone who's a healthcare person, if you know how to cook, come down and
That's
help
right.
us out. I want to go to one more phone call before we go. Kim, if you're on the line with First Edition, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me on. One of the things, and I'll be quick, one of the things that we must do, we have to know our enemy. We have to get to know who the enemy is and why they do what they do. So I would suggest, and I'm always in the library. The library has anything that you want to know about racism, white supremacists. I would suggest to get the beginning of Hitler, rise to power. I would suggest the Nazism, rise to power, and how it came. Get these documentaries and watch them, and it would teach you a lot about racism and separatism and all the things that you want to know. Why? Because a lot of people want to know, why do white people hate black people?
Thank you so much. So I'm sorry, I think we lost Kenneth here, but I think that'd be a good place for us to wrap up this segment. I want to come to Lester and then come over to Rob. So what should people be reading? Is there a resource you think they should read or watch? You already mentioned The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which should be fundamental reading. People should have it in their house right next to their Bible on the shelf. They should be pulling that down to talk about the prison industrial complex and to understand what is happening. But what else should be on this shelf, gentlemen?
Well, so for folk who don't have a lot of time to read, I think going back to giving a shout out to the work Lawrence Brown has been doing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that conception of the black butterfly and the white owl.
Oh, yes.
Where you take a range of resources, whether you're talking about the way bike lanes are articulated or you're talking about development in the city. And he's been able to show pretty definitively that if you just overlay that with a map of Baltimore, where black folk live, that's where you don't see that stuff. Where white folk live, that's where you do see that stuff.
So check it out, Lawrence Brown.
That's online.
At Be More Block. Quick resource from you, Rob.
Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein.
So grab those. We just want to thank you so much, Lester Spence, award-winning author and associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. So happy to have you back, Lester.
Oh, you know how I do. It's
yes,
good to be back.
Yes. Rob Heltenbein, associate dean of the School of Education at Loyola University, Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us, sir, as always.
Thank you.
And we have to take a short break, but we'll be back, and we're going to talk about what every teacher should be teaching about on the first day of school, white supremacy. Don't go anywhere. This is Dr. K on First Edition. Stay with us. I'm your host, Dr. K, sitting in for Sean Oates. Later in the next hour, Khadiji Alakoman will join us for a revamped segment called Living Unbound. We will interview two attorneys and a comedian on the subject of our theme, Time to Reap. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about the alarming rise of awareness of white supremacy in America. We're talking to two teachers here to talk about what every teacher should be talking about on the first day of school. If you are not talking about white supremacy when the students come back, I want to know what you're doing. doing. Joining me is Jesse Schneiderman. He's a history teacher at Frederick Douglass High School. Hello, Jesse. How are you?
Hey, doing Dr. Kay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we have Jessica Schiller. She's a professor of education at Towson University, and she specializes in equity, race, and schooling. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We are excited to have you both. Thank you for joining us here, and welcome to First Edition. When we put this segment together, I specifically wanted to have white teachers on the show. I think that when we talk about these issues of race, we typically have a lot of black teachers talking about what they should be doing. We want to know from the other side. So this is a specific choice to have you in here, not just because of your reputation and your work in Baltimore City, but to talk about how you see it through your lens. How do you approach a classroom for you, Jesse, over at Douglass, mm-hmm. where you have a majority of African-American students? How do you approach your classroom over here at Towson, where you're talking about students who feel they may be removed from this and who could be more activist-oriented? If you want to join our conversation, 410-319-8888. Jesse, let's talk with you first. You could first just tell us where you are in Douglass, what grade do you teach, and kind of the way that you've been approaching teaching about Black Lives Matter in your classroom for the last couple of years.
So I teach history, but I also run all the student activities in the school culture and climate. And I find a lot of my work in equity at the school is in the culture and climate element and making sure that the schools are culturally responsive in the ways that we work with kids. A lot of times schools have a tendency to criminalize behavior that tends to be associated with African-American students, specifically African-American male students. And I think it's really important to understand our students and where they come from and the kind of actions that may be foreign to me as a white teacher and may be something that I would anticipate, or not anticipate, something I would judge as a negative action and kind of view it through a different lens to understand the fact that my students acting a certain way doesn't necessarily mean what I think it means. I need to take a step back and think about it. In the classroom, I run a couple of clubs as well. I run the student government, and I think giving students a voice in school is really important for equity. And I do run the debate team. I also coach the debate team. And our debate arguments, I mean, for Baltimore has a great history at debate, as a lot of people know. And our debate team focuses a lot of our arguments, a lot of our work on research and debate and practice debate focuses around the Black Lives Matter movement because I want them to understand these ideas and I want them to read about them and learn about them. As a history teacher, this year I'll be teaching world history for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I worked on the curriculum. I've been working on the curriculum I'm going to teach. And I looked at the city curriculum and I realized the only time they talk about non-white people is the transatlantic slave trade.
Wow.
And the fact that Chinese people didn't want to trade with Europeans.
Wow.
It's the only time. So, I mean, whatever. I probably shouldn't say this on the air. I'm not teaching the Baltimore City curriculum.
Right.
I'm going to start.
But to me, I want to step in for a second because I think what you just said is really important. Because in our last segment, we talked about moving from actor to ally to accomplice. Mm-hmm. I see what you're doing here and what you're talking about as accomplice work. Like you're doing some direct intervention saying that my new students need to be able to see themselves in history. Mm-hmm. And if I can't find it here, then let me use my classroom as an intervention tactic and bring in other resources. Is that kind of what you're talking about doing?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, they don't talk about anyone other than Europeans until the first at all, unless they're selling other people or other people don't want to trade with them. So it doesn't resonate with the kids, and it makes my job easier to work with topics that resonate with my kids more anyway, aside from the fact that it's just the right thing to do to teach kids about people who are not just a bunch of old white people in Europe.
Well, let me turn to you, Jessica. If you could, as we kind of begin our conversation, frame where you are at Towson. What year do you teach and some of the courses that you're doing this work in?
Good question. So I teach at Towson University in the College of Education. It's a predominantly white institution, although increasingly not. But I train future teachers. I teach a class in ethics, which is a perfect opportunity to start talking about some of the things going on in the world, and I'm also teaching a course called Race, Inequity, and Education. And that's also a great course to put this work front and center. And I do teach predominantly white students, so it's really important to have that in the center of their curriculum.
Do you find that students are receptive? And I'm talking about white students in particular, and for those who are listening, we're doing this very deliberately so we can open up this conversation. Do you find that the white students that you teach, where do they stand on this issue? Now, you haven't gotten them back in this new age, I think, of white. Well, we're talking about white supremacy because if I think both of you might agree with, a couple of months ago, we weren't talking about white supremacy. We were talking about racism. We were talking about Black Lives Matter. We were talking about Donald Trump. And then I believe a shift happened with Charlottesville where all of a sudden white supremacy became the term that we're using. So where do you think your students would stand? They've been talking about Black Lives Matter, obviously. How do you think they're going to deal with this?
So this is going to be an interesting one. I think white students, you know, when they come into a classroom and they are confronted with a question around white supremacy or discussion topic, they're all going to say, you know, condemn it. All of them, almost all of them, you know, universally, you know, we have had, you know, students who, we had a white student union on Towson's mm-hmm. campus. So, you know, I don't want to say universally they will condemn.
On that documentary.
Right. That's right. That's right. So, you know, but they will verbally condemn white supremacy in front of their peers. However, that doesn't mean that they really feel that way. It would be incredibly ostracizing for them to come out and say, yeah, my cousin was at that march in Charlottesville on the side of keeping the statue of Robert E. Lee up, you know. But they I won't find that out until I meet with them one-on-one or their kind of other incidents. Maybe we get into something and you know, white students will reveal this kind of thing, you know, their true feelings about race in other ways. They'll read something that they're not comfortable with, or I send them out into Baltimore City schools and they say, you know, I don't know if this is working out for me. they'll have very kind of polite ways of saying that they're not comfortable talking about this. And I have to really kind of dig deep and push them to get to the bottom of it, which I kind of, you know, I kind of know where it's going. But it's it takes a long time. They have to feel really comfortable in a group setting to really talk openly about race. It's a scary thing for them. And, you know, my attitude is, you know, so what, right?
You should be uncomfortable.
This is what school is, right? This is what learning should be, is being uncomfortable, debating, questioning everything that you know and that you've learned your whole life. But not everyone is there.
And I think it's interesting, Jesse, as I turn back to you, is that the Charlottesville march, riot, because no one else really called it a riot that happened. I mean, when you show up, you're not really doing a peaceful rally and you have, you know, urine-filled balloons and baseball bats and military-style weapons, but happened on a campus, right? Yeah. So this idea of safe space doesn't exist anymore, I believe. And maybe it never really existed for students of color in this broad way. But when we think about it, and your work at Douglas, so when I think of Douglas, and please tell me if I'm wrong, I think of Ground Zero for the Baltimore Uprising. Uh-huh. I think about the things that happened at Mondawmin and the ways in which they tried to box those students in and put them in a position where there was no out, right? So if you have 500 students moving through that stop at Mondawmin Mall, if you stop the subways and stop the buses, then where are you expecting students to go? Right. So what has been the after effect of that, even the framing of how people see Douglas?
So first, I would be doing myself an injustice. A lot of on the day of, you know, I was across the street on the day of at Douglas. Every kid in Baltimore City, for the most part, wears khakis and a polo.
Okay.
And half the kids, as soon as they leave school, take their polo off and they have an undershirt on. Mm-hmm. Or they change it to a different shirt. So what happened was people saw kids in khakis, they saw Douglas across the street, and they said, oh, all those are Douglas kids. They weren't. Mondawmin is a hub of a lot of schools that travel to anywhere in West Baltimore. But that's just because I am very sensitive to the characterization of Douglas as being the main actors in the uprising. But since then, what we've really focused on is making school a positive place. You know, we've had an administration change. That year, we had two interim principals. It was kind of all over the place. We've had an administration change. We focused really hard on making school a comfortable place for kids, making sure that they feel like they belong in school, and making sure that the culture and the climate of the school is a place that they feel they deserve to be and should be, and making it feel accepting. And that includes working on lowering our numbers of exclusionary discipline tactics. That includes on trying to work on a more restorative method for discipline. That includes on trying to use positive behavior interventions. It includes a whole lot of things. I really have to say the teachers at my school, and Jessica and I were talking about this before, I have never worked with a better group of teachers in my life. They're very committed. They're very dynamic. And almost everybody in my school really, really, truly cares about our kids. And I think that that has really helped us turn the climate of Douglas from a place that kids walked in and they immediately shut off or they immediately had a negative kind of feeling to them to somewhere where kids feel welcome and they feel warm.
So what's the percentages in terms of the number of African-American students? Is it 95%?
99.5%.
Okay, so 99.5% students are African-American students.
Yes.
Now, as a white teacher there, how would you and how do you plan to enter into this conversation about white supremacy? Well, first, I'm just assuming you think we should be teaching about this based upon the work you do. So how do you enter into this conversation? Because I think there are a lot of white teachers here in Baltimore City who are teaching in predominantly African-American environments who feel uncomfortable trying to talk about these topics. So can you give us some suggestions here?
Yeah, so I kind of start – so it reminds me of a question a student had for me last year. A student, one of my debate kids actually, randomly asked me, do you ever feel embarrassed to be white? Because we were talking about Black Lives Matter stuff. And I was explaining some of the stuff that the organization does and some of the syllabus that they created and stuff like that. And he asked me that. And I said, yeah. And I kind of started – I kind of hesitated. And he said – and another kid was like, no, but he's from – you know, I'm Jewish. My family immigrated here after World War II. He said, they weren't here then. And I said, yeah, but I have still benefited – quite a bit from being white in this country. My grandparents got loans. My parents got into college. My parents got jobs. They were able to get a loan for our house. Like very specific ways. And that's actually how I try to explain white privilege to my friends who don't believe it exists. Also, I go to house loans as kind of a go-to. So communicating the elements of white supremacy to my kids is really important. They have to be able to spot it in the world. And that's number one. And I need to put myself on the table and say, listen, these are all the ways that I have been privileged, whether or not my family went through the Holocaust, which we did, or not, or immigrated here to Ellis Island, or were here since the 1700s. It doesn't matter, because by being a white person in this country, I've benefited in some way. So whether I identify as Jewish or identify as white or identify as whatever, I am a white passing person. And articulating to my kids what white supremacy looks like and kind of teaching them to pick it out is really important.
If you're just joining us, this is Dr. K here on First Edition, WEAA 88.9 FM. We are talking about how teachers should be tackling the issue of white supremacy, whether you're in the K-12 environment, which is kindergarten through 12th grade, like Jesse is, or you're in a higher ed, which is Jessica Schiller. If you want to join our conversation, please give us a call at 410-319-8888. Jessica, a couple of days ago, there was an incident at Howard University, which is a historically black college and university at HBCU. So two white students were visiting Howard University, and two white females, and they had their hats on, make America great again, make, you know, Trump is important. It's just all this paraphernalia from the top of their head to the bottom of their feet on this historically black campus. Okay, so for the students there, they were very clear about what to do, but the white professors were talking about, so, well, how do we handle this? So what do you think professors can do to be allies, to be accomplices in the work that your students are hopefully going to be engaged in when we begin this new school year?
It's a great question. I mean, like Jesse said, I mean, the first thing is, you know, we have to talk about ourselves. We have to talk about our own biographies. We have to talk about who we are. We have to say, look, you know, those young women who had who are wearing, you know, Make America Great Again hats or whatever. They're white. I'm white. But we don't agree. We don't feel the same way. But that, you know, that doesn't matter when, you know, you're walking down the street, right? Not everybody knows your not everyone's wearing their political affiliation in on their gear, you know. So And I feel like – so I have to – I am very honest and transparent about who I am, where I'm coming from. And as a white person, as a white ally, we have to do that. We have to do that with each other, and we have to do that for our students. Our teachers coming up and even our current teachers are really uncomfortable with that because they never talk about it. And the thing is that we have to constantly be doing – is talking about that. And I know I'm very annoying to my colleagues. They are like, they see me coming and they're like, oh, again with, you know, this talk about race and white supremacy and racism and oppression, you know. But I'm sorry, you know, this is what we have to talk about. The thing that happened in Charlottesville happened because we have never really addressed our tensions around race in this country. We've never really tried. And so until we start talking, and until we start confronting our own our own histories, our histories with each other, all the things that we're talking about on this show today, it's never going to happen. And I have to do this with my colleagues just as much as I do with my students. So I, you know, you're positioning me, and I appreciate it as, you know, someone educating future teachers, which is true, but it's something that I also have to do with my peers. It's also a culture that we have to establish as a predominantly white institution, that we have to take a very clear stance that this is who we are in relationship to other white folks who wave flags mm-hmm. with swastikas and wear white sheets. And we're not those white people.
Well, let's get to our callers. Roger from Baltimore, welcome to First Edition. This is Dr. K.
Hey, Doc.
How you doing?
All right. I was listening to the conversation.
Yes, sir.
And the young gentleman who was speaking, I didn't get name, the young gentleman speaking, clearly is a very progressive-minded young man. I wondered if he ever listened to Dr. Henry Sigmund, who's a fantastic speaker, and he also sees the same thing as opposed to Palestinian and Israeli conflict as right now, and it's pretty much the same thing, Jim Crow for the Palestinians, just like it was for us mm-hmm. back in the 60s mm-hmm. and still ongoing today. I was wondering what his viewpoint is on that.
Thank you so much for calling. Jesse?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks. That's a really, really interesting question, and there's a lot of really excellent groups working, a lot of good Jewish groups. Specifically, I want to shout out If Not Now mm-hmm. is an organization that is pro-Palestinian liberation, and I'm not a part of the group, so I don't want to get their message wrong. But I know that they're a very progressive group made up entirely of young Jews that is very pro-ending the occupation in Palestine, and I tend to align my views almost perfectly with If Not Now. I have family in Israel. My grandfather moved to Israel when it was still Palestine and probably did some stuff that I am not terribly proud of today. I don't know. He never told me. But I agree. It's similar the way the second-class citizenry that they're creating with the Palestinian people is similar. And I think it is terrible. And I really would recommend people who are curious about that and curious about the work that young Jews specifically are doing for that to look at an organization called If Not Now, because they do a lot of really good stuff on that.
Now, Jesse, I also wanted to ask you, because I was with Lawrence Brown and Rob Heffenbein at an mm-hmm. event at the Lewis Museum on Saturday. We were talking about mm-hmm. you know, how monuments and statues matter.
Yes.
And Dr. Brown made this comment. He said that you would never see statues of Hitler up, and people kind of, you know, rallying around them, having picnics under them. Mm-hmm. But that for black people, these Confederate statues, those were our Nazis. Mm-hmm. That if you see it that way, mm-hmm. then maybe it makes sense to you. So I wanted to hear how you're going to talk to your students about what happened in Baltimore City, the removal of the statues, but mm-hmm. even more important than that, than Catherine Pugh making that decision, was all the work done by the folks on the ground. Yes, to get this work pushed forward.
And that's how I'm going to frame it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important to teach the history of this is why the Confederate monuments are a problem. That was actually my final for my debate class last year. They had to construct a debate on whether or not to take down Confederate monuments. But that's the conversation, right, is how did it happen? Because I'm teaching world history this year, but I'm a civics teacher at heart. I love civics and American government and things like that. The focus really is what did people do to make this happen? Because the mayor didn't wake up overnight and decide she was going to take down a bunch of statues. It's not why that happened. That happened because they tore them down in Durham, and they were going to tear them down here, and she was afraid of something happening, so that she decided to take them down herself. So I think the power of the citizenry is the way I'm planning on framing that. But it is really important to point out, and I'll probably be doing this throughout world history, look at all these countries who still have statues up and look at all the ways that different countries have dealt with fascism and with violent oppression after the fact.
And it's something we're talking in higher ed about mm-hmm. too, right? What's the right decision?
Right.
Who do we honor? Who do we not honor? How do we honor them? You know, there were all these reports about Confederate soldiers saying, you know, we really didn't want, I didn't want a statue mm-hmm. put up after me. So, you know, who decided that this was a good idea, right? And we know that this was decided you know, long after the Civil War to put folks on notice.
In response to progress.
Right.
Right. So, right. You know, so we've got to talk about that as a, you know, as a historical dilemma, an ethical dilemma, a dilemma just about being a human being and, you know, in our society. And then, you know, as a teacher, how do you go out there and communicate that? Well, lots of teachers just don't communicate that. I mean, people think about a classroom as being an apolitical, neutral place where they don't bring their opinion into the classroom. And I think it's just the opposite that we have to do in these moments to really help students navigate what this all means. And how do we relate to each other all of a sudden? How do a group of African-American students relate to a white teacher when this has happened,
right,
for instance?
And I used to try to – I used to be apolitical. I used to try to be apolitical in my first teaching job. And then you can't do that. You can't.
I think when the environment, what that doesn't work anymore.
No. And also, like – and also I found that, like, if you are real with your kids, they will be real with you.
Right.
And in order to be real with my kids, I couldn't be apolitical.
Right. There was a time, though, when teachers when the stance was you were supposed to be apolitical.
Right.
But now we know your silence is seen as complicity. I want to get to another caller. Yeah. Charles from Northwest Baltimore. Hello. Welcome to First Edition.
Yes. How you doing?
I'm well.
First of all, I want to applaud you.
Oh, thank you.
For being so bold as to put this topic on the table for discussion. To be so bold as to invite the multi-ethnic division dimensions of this topic. I mean, white, black, Latinos, Asians, all of them need to be involved in this.
Thank you.
My opinion of the teaching profession is that teachers have a stereotype where our children are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They look at them as, you know, people are... individuals who are only interested in having fun or the partying and stuff like that. But from the time our children learn how to read and write and how to count, count from 1 to 10, they have an interest in what makes the world work and how we got to where we are and why we are at this point. And they're quite capable of comprehending and learning in first grade, second grade, third grade, on up.
Right.
And they are quite involved with the world as it is today, and they want to know what makes the world tick.
Right.
And I think for the most part, the schools are locked into a stereotype where they are afraid to break into those areas. So I want to applaud you for this.
Okay.
We need a daily diet of this.
Thank you so much, Charles, for calling. Jess, I'm gonna come to you. So
yeah, I agree 100%. I think that a lot of teachers in the schools of all ethnicities. I think it's largely younger, less experienced, whiter teachers, but it is teachers of all ethnicities have negative stereotypes of our kids. And I think that needs to be confronted very readily and immediately and quickly. And I think that's why it's important to make sure that we're switching the way we do discipline in schools and we're not criminalizing behavior by our black children, because that's not correct, it's not fair, and it's what's been happening for too long, and it leads to kids not caring about school.
Right.
But it's more complicated, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, when you say our kids, we're talking about different groups of kids, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have low expectations of kids generally, I think, in this country, but we have our lowest expectations of our African-American students.
And absolutely. Hispanic students.
And Hispanic
absolutely.
Students.
Yes.
Specifically
And it is about that expectation, but it's also about power. And I think that once you decide to engage a group of young people in a conversation about politics, you have to do a little power sharing with them, because they're going to take that power. Mm-hmm. They're going to say, okay, you know, I want that.
I'm thinking that students are no longer, which I think is interesting, and I want to generalize. If I know generalizations are very difficult to do, right? But students don't seem to be waiting for power sharing anymore, that they are taking the power. I'm thinking about, you know, what just happened in the last couple of nights where activists went down. They started, you know, banging on the Christopher Columbus statue. They're like, you know, take this one down as well. Like, let's take down all vestiges, all reminders, all ways in which we exercise white supremacy in this country. Jessica, I'm going to actually come back to you in our last couple of minutes before I have Jesse give us one resource you can use in your classroom on the day one. So I'll have you think about that. But Jessica, in higher ed, there is another real danger, because I know when I think about people who are sending death threats and emails out to professors who are engaged in this work, how do you work through that? Because that doesn't really happen too much on K-12, but it is happening in higher ed.
Right. No, this is not a good time. in higher ed right now. It's actually a pretty dark time. We've got professors, I know we've talked about this, who are receiving death threats, all kinds of nasty emails. There are professors that have been put on notice and fired,
yes.
whether they have tenure or not. And it's really, really difficult. I'm actually, you know, I'm organizing a conference in October that's ostensibly about equity in education. And I got an email from a couple of emails that had said, you know, we don't like what you're doing and we don't like the focus on race.
Okay.
And so, you know, I've had to navigate through that. I've made people aware. I've made my administrators very aware of what's happening. I want it to be very public. I don't want it to have that be a private thing between me and anyone. Because I want people to know this is a risk that I'm taking, that people take much greater risks. I don't want to equate this with other things,
there is a risk because I'm thinking Baltimore is small. So
right.
when people send, as I often do, get hate mail and death threats, it's not as if this is far removed. We are Smalltimore. Mm-hmm. So you can send me, you know, a death threat or a hate email, then you can see me at Eddie's. You can see me at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. You'll see me in the park. Like, we are just that small.
Yeah.
So I think that in Baltimore, all of these things are more compounded than, say, a place like Atlanta, right? Or a place like LA, which is a lot more spread out.
Absolutely. And so we have to be careful, but we also have to be networked with each other.
Right.
And so I really appreciate you and all my other colleagues that I feel like I have a network of people of real support that know what that experience is like. And I can say, hey, you know, how did you deal with this?
Right.
Because this is problematic. And then we can out these folks for doing this kind of thing to professors, because, you know, where is the, you know, academic marketplace of ideas right now?
Mm.
It's really not happening in K-12, and we have to really work to defend it daily.
Mm-hmm. So now let me come to you, Jesse, because I told you that you're the ruminator on the question here, because I do want teachers to come away from this conversation with not just a moral dilemma, like where do I stand on this and what am I going to do in my classroom,
mm-hmm.
but also a resource. I would, of course, start with saying the Charleston syllabus is out there,
mm-hmm.
and there are many different iterations
many
of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would tell people to go to the Afro and get my op-ed, mm-hmm. because I'm talking about that. But in the last second or so, Jesse, what is one quick source for K-12? And Jessica, what is one source for higher ed?
So I'm going to be teaching What to the Slave is the 4th of July and the first day of school as a primary source to understand the way that we view our holidays from one point of view and how other people view our holidays, or how holidays can be constructed differently by different points of view.
And that's Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass.
What to the Slave is the 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
And also go to Afro and get my op-ed, Blood on the Roots, where I talk about that.
And I also want to shout out the Black Quilt the Narrative.
The Black Quilt the Narrative.
Which is yours.
Which is mine.
It's great.
You can go online, BQN, and you can get resources. Jessica, one quick resource, please.
Charlottesville syllabus is great. I'm teaching James Baldwin this semester.
Excellent.
I'm teaching D. Watkins this semester. I'm teaching all kinds of things that I think are just reading the New York Times these days. Charles Blow, anything he writes, Jelani Cobb, anything he writes is fabulous.
All right. Well, Jesse Schneiderman, history teacher at Frederick Douglass High School, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful school year. Jessica Schiller, professor of education at Towson University, thank you. And we'll have you back on to talk about your October 7th conference. Next, Living Unbound with Khadijah Ali Coleman. This is Dr. K. Don't change the dial. Stay with us.